The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because they are
easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to the Space Show this Tuesday evening. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in. We have two guests with us tonight that I will introduce in just a second. A great topic dealing with consumer 3D printers. In fact, one of the questions that our guests are going to answer for us is what use is a consumer 3D printer? But more about that in just a moment. Our toll-free number for those of you who would like to call us is 1-866-687-7223. Do remember there are no call screeners, so let the phone ring and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also use email, and that is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And you can also post a comment or question for our guest on our blog, and so go to thespaceshow.com website. On the far right is the upcoming show menu, and this is the number one show listed up at the top. And if you open it up, that is our archive page for this program tonight. Scroll down to where the comments are and comment or question away. And remember, you do not have to log in to discuss, to give us a comment or a question. You can do so as a guest. And as soon as you post it, I will get a copy of it and can bring it to the attention of our guest today. Our website is thespaceshow.com, so make sure you become familiar with our detailed website newsletter. It's on the right side, center right of our website. So it details the programs for this week, and we have Hotel Mars Friday and Sunday remaining for this week. And then if you scroll down, it shows you our complete schedule that we have booked, and we're still booking into the end of the first quarter of 2017. But you'll see who we have planned coming up in the near future, all the way through to the end of the first quarter. Everything we do is archived. You can listen off of our site very easily, and you can quickly download our program if you want to get them onto another device. A 90-minute show is maybe 13 megabytes using the file format we're using now, so you should be able to download that maybe in a minute if you're using high-speed internet. There's a menu at the upper left, and under support is our Space Show store. So if you want T-shirts or coffee mugs or license plate frames or hats or pens or something like that with the Space Show logo on it, that is the location for getting those items. And then also there is a Listen Live button. So this gives you instructions to share with people on how to listen to a live show as well as to all of our archive shows. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Clearly, to me, the most important button on the program is support the Space Show button. Remember, we are a nonprofit 501c3 with one, giantleapfoundation.org. And we are able to bring you these programs and our content for free because many of you do financially support the Space Show. And we are certainly appreciative of your support. We thank you for that very much, and without your support, we would not be able to continue doing the Space Show. Do remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you get a deduction for your gift to the Space Show, and if you're a California taxpayer, you also get a deduction off of California with the Franchise Tax Board. As in California, we are a public benefit corporation. So if you have any questions about any of that, do visit onegiantleapfoundation.org. Or email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We do have sponsors. You'll see their banner ads running across our website. And for the first segment of today's program, we have three sponsors that I would like to tell you about. So the first one is a Celestis Minute regarding the new Celestis DNA service. And remember, Celestis is the premier global provider of Memorial Spaceflight Services. They've been around since 1995. But now it doesn't have to be Memorial. You can send part of yourself as well with their new DNA service. Since 1997, their services have flown people's ashes into space, providing uniquely compelling post-cremation memorial services. But now Celestis offers you the opportunity to fly your DNA into the final frontier, not your ashes. Thanks to Celestis's partnership with CG Labs of Canada, this is the world's leader in DNA collection and home storage for consumers. Celestis extends personal spaceflight options beyond memorial services to everyone living on the planet today. The new Celestis service also stores DNA off-planet through Celestis lunar and deep space missions and provides you with a kit that you can use to store your DNA at home. Moreover, families that choose traditional burial can fly their loved one's DNA on a Celestis mission. Indeed, living family members can include their own DNA on board a memorial space flight with Celestis, along with the ashes of their deceased relative. So remember, visit them. Get more information at Celestis, CELESTIS.com. And I'm thinking of flying some of my DNA into space. So if I decide to do that, I will let everybody know about that. AIAA is a sponsor. That is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. And they have five annual forums, which are really conferences. And they're called SciTech, Defense, Aviation, Propulsion, and Energy, and Space. And they bring together like-minded aerospace pros across industry, academia, and government for a blend of energy, plenary sessions, in-depth foreign 360 programs, robust technical programming, and networking opportunities that jumpstart dialogues, discoveries, collaborations, and careers. Boy, is that a mouthful, right? AIAA's members help make the world safer, more connected, more accessible, and more prosperous. And if you attend an event, you will experience all of that because their networking and warmth and friendship and information sharing and all of it is really second to none. So check them out and attend their events, AIAA.org. And then also for this first segment, Orbital ATK is a sponsor. They're the global leader in aerospace and defense technologies. They are known as the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And we certainly appreciate and thank every one of our sponsors. And do check their banner ads across the website from time to time. So we have two guests with us today. Joan Horvath is back with us, as is Rich Cameron. And they are both co-founders of Non-Scriptum LLC. And this is a Pasadena-based consulting firm and training firm founded in early 2015. It teaches educators and scientists how to use MakerTech. And they are specialists in 3D printing, desktop 3D printing, and a lot more. So I want to spend as much time talking with them as possible, not reading about them. So their full bios are up on the website. So I urge you to read about each of them on the website. And as I said, they have a question, what use is a consumer 3D printer? And they go on to say, at the moment, there are a lot of overblown claims about 3D printing, as well as people genuinely doing great stuff. But what can you really do with a printer that is in the $1,000 to $3,000 range? Well, Joan is going to start us off and tell us that. Hi, Joan. Welcome back to the show. Rich, hello to you as well. Joan, introduce us to what you're doing, because we do have new listeners that probably haven't heard your past show.
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, really thank you, David, for that great introduction. And I realized while I was listening that I've been an AIAA member for 40 years. That's a really depressing number.
I know. About it. I haven't been that long, but let's see. I started my dissertation probably 1995, so Somebody better than me can do the math, but yeah, I've been a member a long, long time.
Yeah, because I started as an undergraduate, so they're a great organization. So that's a
40 years, really.
Yeah, started as an undergrad, so yeah. So I'm pleased that they're our sponsor for this, or one of our sponsors. That's awesome. So anyway, yeah, we've been doing a lot of things. I spent a long time at JPL, and then I think I probably was on your show first then, and since have kind of migrated through a lot of different entrepreneurial things. But
well, you had written a consumer magazine article about something, and John Juris gave it to me when I was at a Space Access meeting many, many years ago in Phoenix. And what was the magazine that you wrote an article? It was a sort of a consumer-oriented article about something to do with space.
I think I wrote for Scientific American, kind of a survey of what was going on with the XPRIZE.
Something like that, yeah. And that was your first space show program.
Probably, yeah. So that was quite a while ago. I think that was early in the XPRIZE days. But to move on to new things and not how old we are, because Rich wasn't even around for most of that. So what our new company does is that, first of all, we have five books we've collaborated on in this space that are available from our publisher, A-Press. And if you go to our non-scriptum website, which will be on David's page afterwards, you can see those. But, we're both at a 3D printer company, an entrepreneurial Kickstarter company. We realized that nobody was teaching people how to use this technology. It was sort of being put out there. It was open source. There was all kinds of information about it, but it was sort of an excessive feast. You know, there was so much stuff out there that if you're a beginner, there was sort of no obvious place to start. And so what we've tried to do is to kind of walk through all that great sea of information out there and to try to, first of all, you know, the good thing about the Internet is there's so much stuff on it. The bad thing about the Internet is there's so much stuff on it. And that's sort of triply true for a lot of things like 3D printing. And so, we've seen this field really grow. And in a minute, I'll let Rich sort of maybe tell his history about it a little bit. But, it's now at the point where there are, what did we figure out the other day? There's like, how many 3D printer companies, roughly?
Oh, hundreds at least.
Are you kidding? There's that many?
Well, the issue is people get a 3D printer and decide that they're going to use it to make money by selling their own 3D printers. You can use a 3D printer to make parts for a 3D printer. And most of these people who decide to do this don't know what they're doing and end up taking an existing design and making it worse.
Interesting.
You know, so, I mean, to sort of fill in your listeners who haven't followed this whole thing, I mean, 3D printing has been around, well, pretty much since I joined AIAA, just about, it was originally a proprietary technology. It was sort of invented several different places, a lot of it out of MIT, and the folks who licensed it elected to make it a very expensive technology and not to try to push down the cost, and that's a business decision they made, right? But the patents ran out in the mid-2000s, and there's a professor at University of Bath in England, and he said, oh, this patent's running out, so what I can do is I can develop a 3D printer that can print other 3D printers, and I'll put it out open source and try to let people evolve it. And so that kind of blew open the field, I guess maybe, sort of 10-ish years ago now. And, it's just been kind of wild ever since, because by definition, people are making machines to evolve other machines. And, where that evolution goes doesn't have to only be other 3D printers, but it can be, whatever, insert interesting robotic or custom device of your choice.
What kind of I don't know, fuel's probably not the right word, but what do you print with? What is the substance that you have to put into the machine to use in the end product?
The type of machine we use the most uses stuff called filament, and it looks like weed whacker wire, but isn't. And there are all kinds of filaments now, but you know, the common one, there are two common ones, or maybe three, and I'll let Rich talk about the exotic ones, but the common ones are PLA, which is, it's a compostable plastic, so a lot of your, the compostable utensils you get, some places might be PLA. It's a plastic with a low melting point, which has issues. So if you leave something 3D printed out of PLA on a car dashboard in California in the summer, the results can be kind of dolly-like.
Okay.
You know, you get this melted thing. The next step up is ABS, which is Lego plastic. And that's a little harder to work with for various reasons, but it's pretty good. And then a lot of real parts are made out of nylon, and a lot of 3D printers, consumer printers can handle nylon.
Can a printer do all three of them, or do you have to choose a printer that will print one of them?
So basically any machine is going to be able to do PLA. The other materials kind of depend on some of the features of the printer, both the temperature that it can reach, the material the platform is made of, whether plastic will stick to it or not, because you need a platform that you're printing onto where the material will adhere, but not permanently.
So if you want to print a food item or a pair of shoes, what can you do that with a cheap printer, or do you need to elevate your sights a little bit?
A food item would be done with a different tool head. Usually that would be syringe-based, or there are some pump-based paste extruders. They can print edible materials. Now, it's not really any more food when it comes out than when it goes in. But it might look more aesthetically pleasing.
What about if you wanted to print shoes or clothing or something? Is that a different tool head or a different kind of printer?
I've seen 3D printed shoes and clothing items made on a standard consumer 3D printer. They are not exactly what you would think when you say shoes or a standard piece of clothing, but more like chainmail for clothing usually, and a shoe. Not sure if I've seen an actual shoe made that way, but certainly an insole made out of a flexible material.
Okay, and for space, can you do anything useful with a low-cost consumer printer for space applications?
Well, it depends on the material. So, you know, there are certainly people developing all kinds of things. I'm not sure who has flown exactly what at this point. You know, certainly a lot of people are interested in it. So the issues are that you have to make sure whatever the material is space stable. And also I think you need to, you know, there needs to be obviously some testing. We had a good conversation the other day with, the folks at Mark Forged, which is a small company in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And they are—they already have a printer that can print composites of a sort. And they are in a couple of months going to release a printer that can print metal at sort of about the $100,000 range. And the composite one is much cheaper than that. So that's an interesting possibility.
When you say metal, are we talking aluminum, or what are you talking about for the metal?
I believe there are a number of different metals that they plan to release. The printer is not available yet, but I believe they are. There's a range of metals that it will be able to use.
I have the first email question for you. You guys ready for this?
Sure.
Okay, so Perry is in Denver, Colorado, and he says, on other space show programs, I've heard people advocating all sorts of uses for desktop small printers, especially if they were laid off of work and they needed to get some income. They could do different projects with end results that could be sold. What can or can't really be done with a small printer, and can you really make marketable stuff with it that others might buy? I'm not talking about what you said earlier by making another printer with the printer, but is there an end product that somebody can actually make with one of these small printers and make money with it?
Well, I think you know, there are a couple of different regimes. One is that you can make things with a printer that you could then use as a pattern for traditional casting, and certainly people are doing that. And you know, so you print something and you insert it in the process for either lost wax, PLA. The PLA material can be used pretty much where you would use wax, and there are also things that are a little closer to traditional wax that you can use. And so that is an interesting option. For things that are prototypes, certainly, you know, I think there's some interesting issues with strength and stability of a print. I like to say that 3D printers are kind of poor person composite layup for things, because the prints, I'm waving my hands and this isn't going to help, is it? The prints are laid up a layer at a time. And so you lay up, if you imagine that you have a platform in front of you, you would lay up the first layer of your part. If you were making something that was cylindrical, a donut shape, for instance, you would lay up the first layer of the donut, and the second and third, and so on. And you would get your donut over time, and through the thickness of the donut, you'd have layers. And those layers, the bonds between the layers are not as strong as within the plane of the torus of the donut. So, you know, there are some issues like that the material is not homogeneous, that you have to think about with a real part. But the things people are doing now for kind of real stuff are mostly, you know, architects or early adopters, people who are making prototypes of product designers who want to make a prototype for user testing, or maybe want to send their model instead of just sending sketches to China or wherever it gets made. They can actually send a real thing so that people have a better idea of what they're doing. Maybe Rich wants to add some things here about real stuff.
To give a concrete example of how people are making money with consumer 3D printers, there are services, there are high-end services, bureaus where you can get something made on a high-end printer. There are also a couple of services that are like Uber for people who have these low-cost machines where you can send them a file and they'll print it on their printer and ship it to you. And so that's the main way that people are making money with their 3D printers now.
So there
are also small items, often toys, that are sold on sites like eBay or Etsy. And to sell something like that, you really want to have some design skill. But basically running out time on your printer doesn't require a whole lot of skill with design. You still need to be able to take somebody's file and get decent results with it.
So when you say a file, what are they actually sending you? I am assuming what they send has to conform to the 3D printer, right?
So the printers use a file in a format called STL. People will tell you that stands for Standard Tessellation Language, but I think that's a backronym, and it was originally just short for stereolithography. So that is a format where a 3D object is built up out of triangles covering a surface, and it's a standard exchange format that any 3D printer will be able to read.
So if I wanted to make a part for my exotic 50-year-old car motor, I would have to create that part in that file format, and then with that file format, you could print it.
Yeah, so you're going to use some kind of CAD program to design that part, and then they can all export an STL file.
and it would actually work?
Well, if it was a part of your engine, then the materials were compatible. You know, if it's in the middle of a hot part of your engine, you're not going to use a PLA part there and probably not a nylon part. But if your seatbelt, some random little annoying small thing broke, like a cup holder side or something, then that might be appropriate.
My sister's car, for instance, has a seat adjustment handle that I printed after the original one broke.
Okay.
And one of the issues is that people say, well, can I just copy something? But scanning has not kept up with the printers. And the consumer-level scanners that we have seen to this point have issues, mostly because if you make like a monster hand in front of your face, curl up your fingers and sort of look at the palm.
Uh-huh.
And if you, the way most scanners work is that they illuminate the object with one laser beam broken into a bunch of beams. And so if you imagine that laser beam scanning your hand sort of clutched together like that with a shadowed surface, what happens is you have to make a whole bunch of scans to illuminate all that, and then you have to manually match them as best you can, and there's usually lots and lots of artifacts. So the people who really know what they're doing very often charge $1,000 for a good scan for, Hollywood purposes. That's because there's so much touch labor in it. So that's an area that has not really kept up. And so you can't really take apart, scan it, and go poof. There are a lot of people that are trying to do that, and maybe some of them have made more progress than we're aware of at the moment. But by and large, the results have been a lot of work, and the quality is kind of iffy enough that you scan something. Usually what people do is they scan something, and then they slurp it into a CAD program, and then they use that as a guide to just draw one.
So if you're wanting to start an entrepreneurial CubeSat company, and you're going to make CubeSats to do something, can you use one of these small desktop printers to make most of the parts of the CubeSat, or only a few parts of it, or no parts of it? Like, can it make electronic parts?
Not yet. There's a thing called an other mill, which is kind of a small desktop mill by Other Machine, which is kind of an interesting thing that lets you etch circuit boards. And if your listeners haven't heard of other mills, they might be interested in looking at those. They're not printers. They're subtractive. It would come down to the material, and I am not aware yet about whether anybody has 3D printed a part for flight and what material exactly they've used for that. There are, certainly for the very expensive proprietary printers, there are things that are aviation certified, and I don't know if anybody, maybe one of your listeners will jump in, has flown nylon off a consumer grade printer or not.
So
there are a couple of machines that are related to 3D printers that print with a silver ink or some similar material that can make circuits. There is also one machine which I was just checking. I'm not sure if it's available yet. Which is a 3D printer that can also print with these materials and embed them in a print. There was also another machine just recently that was on Kickstarter that was claiming to be able to do this, but it turned out that the people running the Kickstarter campaign were deceiving their backers.
Oh,
so
strange.
The campaign was shut down.
Lucky they found out about that.
There's like anything with a lot of hype, there are people doing great stuff and people who claim to be doing great stuff. And as people have been in entrepreneurial aerospace for a while, you and I have both seen a lot of either kind of that.
So what is the next price point after a consumer printer between $1,000 and $3,000? Where do you go next?
Up or down?
There's
down, amazingly enough now.
What can you do with something going down?
There are pretty decent printers at $400 now.
Really?
That's about the That's about the cutoff for plausibility in our experience so far. I mean, there may be things out there that are okay, but that's kind of the pretty decent lower end, just, you know, when it comes to parts and quality, because it's a precision machine. But there are machines that aren't bad that are about $400. And, you know, the software is open source and free. Pretty much you can do everything with free software that you might reasonably want to do. And there's that. The other big application we haven't really talked about is education. And, you know, we are very interested in how do you help people visualize things. We have a book called 3D Printed Science Projects, which is aimed at getting people started, because people have trouble often getting started, and a lot of teachers just have kids download things they find off the internet and print them, and what do you learn from that? So we have developed some models where you have to learn a little bit of physics or chemistry or whatever it is, and then you can start altering the models. And that's been quite popular. And a niche where it's been extremely popular is people who are visually impaired for obvious reasons, people who are teaching blind kids. And we have a pro bono project linked on our website for people to develop science models for blind kids, if anybody's interested in that. So I think that helping people visualize in 3D is a bigger change than you would think. And one of the things we've discovered is that, you know, when we've gone to make 3D models, so for instance, one of our models is Kepler's laws in plastic, I like to say. And excuse me, Kepler's laws govern how planets go around the sun or each other or
right.
planets and so on. And so one of our models is an orbit in one plane, and then the third dimension is the height. Is how fast the planet is going in its orbit at that point. And people have just been charmed by those, like Halley's Comet looks like a shoehorn, you know, because it accelerates vastly as it goes toward the sun, and then it kind of goes down to almost nothing toward the end. And so it's been very interesting, you know, the insights you get just by doing that. We've discovered almost every textbook has the same illustration as each other. You know, they redraw them so they don't get sued. But pretty much they all have the same drawing. And when you actually go to say, okay, how am I going to make a 3D illustration, as it were, you have to think very differently, more differently than you think. And we've actually put together, we have an online class just to teach people how to do that, because it really is a little lateral than a little more lateral than what we thought when we got into it.
How do they find your online class?
Well, it runs for the first time next month, so we'll find out.
No, but I mean, how do they find it? Do you just go to your website?
Well, it's linked on our website under classes.
So if you're wanting to have a business and you're thinking 3D printing might be useful for you, do they go to you for advice and consulting as to, like, what kind of printer to get, or can a printer even do what you're thinking about doing? Because most people don't even know where to go.
Yeah, well, the first book we did is called Mastering 3D Printing, and that's been out, gosh, over 2 years now. And it's sort of reassuring in a weird way that it hasn't aged much, because it was kind of written to not to age too much. But so an awful lot of people start there. That's just available on Amazon, and so a lot of people find us. A lot of people actually find us because they find that book. And there are a couple other good books out there now, too. Not as good as ours, of course. We're smiling. Anyway.
But do you take on private clients as well? Like, can people have you consult for them and help them?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people we steer to our class. We have an online 4-week-long class. A beginning class, and we've just added this 3D visualization class, and then we also have an online electronics class. And those are all taught through Learn Network, LERN, and Learn is an outsourced online training provider for community colleges. So, for instance, Pasadena Community College here, which is a state community college, outsources a lot of its online learning to various contractors, including LEARN. So the classes get listed in a lot of community college brochures, and depending on how people come into it, they can get CEUs and stuff like that. So we steer people our classes, and if they want to do something specialized, we consult and help them do that, either if they're local by meeting with them, if they're distant by Skype, and you know, that's sort of our business model.
Are there a lot of companies to choose from if you want to buy a printer, or do you have to be careful about what you're doing?
Well, there's as Rich said, there's like 300.
At least.
Yeah, but they're probably not all that you'd want to be associated with or involved with. So how do they know who the good companies are? Is there a consumer rating for 3D printers?
Well, there's Make Magazine does a subset of them every year, so there's that. We have an affiliate relationship with a retailer called Matter Hackers, and Matter Hackers kind of does calls, you know, a bit, and elects to carry 3D printers that they are comfortable with, and so we often send people to them to actually buy a printer because we don't sell anything. We don't sell hardware. So that's often what we do because they're kind of cognizant day by day of what models are available and price points and things. And so, you know, there are a handful of printers that we recommend more than others. And it's just, you know, usually we just say, what are you trying to do with it? Because the material choice will determine how complex a printer you need. There are flexible materials, for instance, that are elastomers, and a lot of printers can't print those. And if you really, really want to print inflexible materials, then you need to have a printer that can handle that, just as an example.
So if you want to go up beyond the $1,000 to $3,000 point, where does the market start to change again? Do you have to go to like to $20,000, or can you go to $5,000, or again, is it all based on what you want to print?
Well, there's the composite printer we mentioned earlier, which is around $1,300, and of course there are other printing technologies. There are powder-based printers and liquid resin-based printers. The liquid resin printers are going to give you smoother surfaces and finer details, but the resin materials tend not to be as strong. The powder prints are tend to be porous, and depending on the material, may not be as strong unless you go all the way up to metal, which, as we mentioned, there's a machine coming to the market soon, which is about $100,000. Other than that, it's going to be difficult to spend less than $1 million on a metal printing machine.
This is really a big world you have to tread in. I mean, I could see a novice getting totally lost in this.
Yeah, and many do. And I think Rich meant 13,000, not 1,300 for the composite printer, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but you know, it's a thing, you know, and one of the things that's interesting is that a 3D printer isn't always the best tool, too. You know, for many things, laser cutting is a very good tool. And laser cutters are more of an industrial thing. You know, you kind of have to have them ventilated to the outside, and if you don't know what isn't safe to cut, you can do tearful things like release chlorine gas. So you have to know not to cut certain things. But if you get trained on it, a laser cutter for, you know, if you're going to cut out things that are sort of, you know, 2D shapes, is much faster. It's a big drawback of 3D printing right now, and probably forever, because of the nature of the technologies, it's slow. You know, to print something fist-sized might be several hours at least, and maybe more than that. And so, you know, people will get banks of 3D printers to do things, you know, if you're doing that, but it's, you know, I mean, carving something with a mill isn't particularly fast either. So, you know, it's not, you know, it's competitive with a lot of the subtractive technologies, but people see all these videos sped up of a 3D printer printing, and then they come and see one and they get fascinated, and then they look at their watches and say, when's this going to, you know,
when's it going to be over with, right?
Is this going to, you know, and, you know, it's, we do a lot of events, and we do a lot of sort of, you know, big public events and free things and stuff, and for people who haven't seen this before, and that's sort of how we, you know, that's our marketing, and so people are always fascinated watching it and shocked at how long it takes to have anything happen, and that's sort of the big things in the space right now.
Helen is in Seattle, and Helen said, if you're studying engineering in school, especially an aerospace engineering class, do you get 3D printing, or is most of this coming now after school or away from school with on-the-job training?
Well, it probably depends on where you go to school. I mean, I know MIT is doing a lot of it. That's where I went to school, and is developing a lot of technology, actually. Certainly, specific schools get into this. Pasadena State College, which I mentioned before, has a really good fab lab and has been doing some amazing things down there. And we've with other hats, we've worked with them some. And a lot of K-12 schools actually are buying them. The majority of our business at the moment has actually been K-12 schools wanting to, you know, get some advice and counsel on how to get started and get their faculty trained and so on. And so there's a lot of energy there, a lot of expectations that they're going to take something out of the box and use it. And actually, our company name comes from that. We thought about calling ourselves Now What, because we figured that's what people did when they unboxed their 3D printers. They'd say Now What.
Now What? Well, actually, they probably say something different.
So they might say something different. But if you're talking to K-12 teachers, with the story that our story, and we're sticking to it, is that it's Now What. We changed that to sort of a Latin version of non-scriptum instead, which sort of means unwritten. But anyway, you know, people have been sold a little bit on, oh, you take it out of the box and poof, you can print anything. And I say it's about like cooking. You know, if you go out and you buy yourself a baking pan and a couple of measuring spoons, maybe a cookbook, you can make a wedding cake, in principle, right?
Right, but you may not want to eat it.
But it's not going to, you probably don't want to make a wedding cake with 12 layers and brides and grooms on the top as your first thing out of the boat. But everybody wants to make a wedding cake first when they get a 3D printer. They don't want to make themselves a keychain or something. And so that's some of the issue, is that it is really literally like, it's basically cooking with plastic, which doesn't sound very appetizing, but the skill level and the kinds of things you need to worry about, you know, temperature, and there's a lot of, just like with cooking, I mean, you can get a recipe and your particular oven might have a slightly cockeyed thermostat, and that is true with consumer 3D printers too, that, you know, things can be a little off. The material might be rated to be used at a certain temperature, and everybody who's been in this field a long time knows that every manufacturer is a little different, and some of them tend to be a little lower than their rated amount, something, and this kind of stuff, which just comes with experience. And so very often we walk into a place where they're tearing their hair out, and we calm them down and just figure out what their problems are, and then they're fine. You know, but there's that curve is kind of a little nasty sometimes.
To drag out the cooking analogy, there are printers on the market that are trying really hard to be a microwave oven rather than the big oven in your kitchen, which is much simpler to use. But you can't really cook anything more complicated than a TV dinner in a microwave. So you need some of that. You need some of that ability to stay if you really want to be able to do stuff.
So that ties into this question I'm going to ask you, and then we'll go to break because we're at the halfway point. So this is Frank in Tucson, and he says, I have two kids in middle school, and I thought about getting them some sort of a simple 3D printer just for them to play with to start to learn how to use it, even if it's to make nothing other than a toy or something. Is that a good approach for introducing kids to this technology, and what kind of simple printer is good for kids that are in middle school where they could just sit down and use it kind of like a simple computer?
Well, most of the software and stuff is sort of rated for kids 13 and above, but you can have a parent permission to use it. There's a wonderful online, the limiter for most people is the CAD program, and so there's a wonderful free online program called Tinkercad at tinkercad.com. And you have to be 13 to use it or have parental permission, so there's that. The PrinterBot, which has no E, PrinterBot, P-R-I-N-T-R-B-O-T, Play, is a nice machine in that $400 range. And we know the PrinterBot people well, and they have made a real nice little, pretty destruction-proof machine insofar as you can. And so that's a good solid machine at the lower end of the range, and that'll probably serve them for a while. I know if Rich wants to add anything there.
There are some, especially we've seen just at CES this year, Consumer Electronics Show, there are some printers that are really trying to be toys. And they're trying to be easier to use, but the problem comes when the technology is not really ready to be a toy. Eventually your nozzle will clog, and you need a machine that where it's possible to fix that. Some of these toy machines, it's doubtful whether that will be possible.
Interesting that they're not really made to be a toy, even though some parents, like Frank, sort of want it to be a toy for their kids.
Well, it can certainly be an educational item. I would not consider it a toy in the same way that, say, an Xbox or, if you're smaller, a toy truck would be.
It's sort of closer to a soldering iron, which a certain type of child would have as a toy in double quotes, with parental supervision and guidance that would be implied with that. I would put it closer to a soldering iron than a toy truck.
Well, you could get hurt with a soldering iron. Can you get hurt with a 3D printer?
Well, it's the nozzle's hot. There is a hot nozzle in there. It is a precision machine. It is an electrical device. And so I would say it's closer to a soldering iron than to most things.
If you stick your fingers in the right in the wrong place, they can get pinched. If you touch the nozzle while it's printing, you're going to get burned. But I'd say it's probably easier not to hurt yourself when you're using a 3D printer properly than when you're using a soldering iron properly.
Okay, we're going to pause. We're a little beyond the halfway point. Listeners, we are going to take a pause, and hopefully some of you can give us a call instead of just using email. 1-866-687-7223, and email remains drspace, drspace, @thespaceshow.com, and we will be back in about 3 minutes. Don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Tuesday evening Space Show program. We're talking about 3D printing and what you can actually do with it, among other topics. Joan Horvath is with us. Rich Cameron is with us. And their company is Nonscriptum LLC. Their website, www.nonscriptum.com. And we have two sponsors for today's second part of our show. And one of them is the Space Finance Group, which is a team of space advocates with crowdfunding experience. Members of their team have helped raise over $1 million through crowdfunding. We'd like to help you raise the funds you need to get your space project going. If your space idea can be moved forward for under $250,000, crowdfunding can be an ideal solution. We're the only crowdfunding team that specializes in space projects. We understand space, we're the people behind the Integrated Space Plan, and we understand the audience you need to reach. Visit us online at spacefinancegroup.com, that's all one word, and you can also reach us at jay.whitner, W-I-T-T-N-E-R, at spacefinancegroup.com, and please remember, no buck, no buck Rogers. And then the Space Foundation is a sponsor, and they have the 33rd Space Symposium coming up April 3rd to the 6th in Colorado Springs, Colorado. This is 2017's must-attend space industry conference where global space professionals, leaders, and decision-makers converge. So check them out. Reservations are really needed. Maybe 12,000 to 15,000 people jam into Colorado Springs, so do get your reservations early. SpaceSymposium.org is their website. Guys, during the break, you mentioned that 3D printing had some applications for space settlement or colonization. Please elaborate on that. That's also a very big topic of interest for Space Show listeners.
I know a lot of people have been looking at various ways of trying to 3D print volcanic regolith. I know the Hawaiians certainly have been very interested in that. I think in Hawaii have been playing around with trying to 3D print some sidewalks and things like that with ground up volcanic regolith somehow. And so I think that is an interesting space. People have certainly also been playing around with creating different kinds of concrete to 3D print. The challenge there is how do you get some kind of mixture that you can extrude somehow. I mean, most of these work by if you imagine a sort of an overgrown cake decorating thing. You know, you have this mixture that you extrude and lay up into your 3D print and then do various things with. So there's some folks at University of Southern California doing that, and the Hawaiians. And Rich is going to add something here.
And the other way to do 3D printing with in-situ materials on potentially on another planet would be to do a variation of the powder printing methods that are common among higher-end 3D printers. The idea would be that you either create a layer of regolith or whatever kind of rock or dirt that's available on wherever you're trying to colonize, and add a binding material so that you can use in-situ materials to build up structures rather than needing something that's more processed than that. The other thing that might be possible with some of them is to actually sinter those materials. There was a project done a while ago by an artist, I believe, that used a big magnifying glass and a Cartesian robot, like the one used in a 3D printer, to sinter sand out in the desert and create solid objects out of the sand that was already there. And using the sun's energy to melt it.
Well, NASA had some kind of contest along these lines, and we looked into it, but it required fairly elaborate facilities, and so we decided that we wouldn't be competitive unless we rounded up a university team, and we sort of moved on. But there was a substantial 3D printing challenge that must be pretty far along by now, so it might be interesting to see what the results of that are.
You have a question from Ben, and Ben is in San Diego, and he says many guests as well as callers to space show programs always advocate the use of 3D printing and how it's going to change and revolutionize the space industry, space settlement, rockets, all of it. Everybody says 3D printing is the big game changer. Do you see that happening now, or is it too early for that to be happening now? Will it happen in 20 years or 30 years, or is it overrated?
That's one of those questions that the answer is yes to all of it. I think let's unpack that a little bit. So I think in the short run, certainly SpaceX is doing some very exciting things. We don't know what kind of printers they're using, but they've been printing a lot of rocket parts in the short run. And if you can afford a very expensive metal printer, you can make some very interesting things. Or you can also, there are services who will print out complex metal parts for you and print that as a service. So in the exotic end, that's interesting. The two areas where I think it's really interesting are, so if you are on orbit and you don't want to have a lot of spares and you have things that are, not requiring high strength or particularly, a challenging thermal or chemical environment, if you have a 3D printer that works and you have some backups for it, you can make a lot of the things that otherwise you might carry as spares, all the little plastic nonsense that you usually have to have tons of extras on, in your house, right? All the little doohickeys that you say, oh, I really need one. I mean, if you're in space, you're out of luck, right?
Right.
And on Mars, that'll go double, right? So if you can make all the random little things, I know we're now coming into our second year of doing a program with the American Association for Advancement of Science on called the Scientific Maker Symposium. And the next one is in Hawaii in this June. And if you're interested in that, you can come to the contact us on our site, and we'll send you the call for proposals. But a lot of people in laboratories using 3D printing just use them for random little stuff that otherwise is expensive, things to do specialized holding of things that otherwise somebody would have to make one, or maybe, people sell a holder for this piece of equipment that costs $500 just because they can. And, so you can make random little pieces of lab equipment and prototypes. So I think that's a space for it.
And if you follow the 3D printing news, it seems like every week there's another story about some aerospace company 3D printing a part, either because a part that actually goes on a plane or even a rocket. And they do this often because it makes sense. It's economically viable to print small quantities of things rather than going to injection molding, which generally is considered to have a minimum part count of 10,000. So if you're making a one-off spaceship, or if you're prototyping something especially, it makes more sense to 3D print. People are also finding ways to optimize parts, making them stronger while removing material and creating a shape that can only be made by 3D printing, but that is just as strong and much lighter than a part that would be made another way.
Can you make critical parts, or is most of this all about non-critical parts?
Well, you know, we're not in this sphere. We're more in the consumer sphere ourselves, so we're speculating a little bit here.
Okay.
But given that we don't work with any aerospace companies at the moment. We work mostly with consumer folk, people doing prototypes and stuff like that. But that they're going to make out something else later, which is where a lot of the market is. Certainly people who have purchased these multi-million dollar big machines, or who are vending out their printing to someone who has, can certainly make critical parts that way.
I have a friend who just got a bank loan for $1 million printer for his tool shop over in the East Bay. And I don't know exactly what he makes, but he makes parts for other companies as well. And he says they are critical parts that he's making, but it's $1 million-plus. He said giant machine. He showed me the catalog for it. And, of course, I had no idea what I was looking at, but it looked pretty sophisticated and pretty big machine.
Yeah, most of those are metal powder machines, and so the metal powder is difficult to handle for a whole bunch of reasons. And so a lot of them have to have their own atmosphere systems and
it had to have his own environmental system.
Yeah.
In their tool plant.
So they have to manage all that. So if you make the investment, you know, it's a very powerful tool. It's like buying a 5-axis gigantic CNC machine. Once you've bought that, you can make all kinds of interesting things. But you know, it's the barrier's quite high for those parts still. And time will tell how this $100,000 Mark Forged printer is in quality relative to those. And, you know, we'll see that in a few months, I think.
Dr. Doug is in Southern California. Actually, he's not too far from you. And he says, doohickeys don't sound... Interesting how you spelled that, Doug. Doohickeys don't sound particularly mission-critical. Are there small 3D printers, regardless of the cost, that make strong mission-critical parts, and could those be finished in the field?
Well, it depends on what your mission is. I mean, if you're making metal, the answer is no. What you could do, and what we've, you know, worked with people to do, is you could certainly make a mold, either make a positive. We've done sand casting from a 3D print. The way sand casting works is you make a positive, you make a thing that looks like whatever it is. You take that and you press it into sand that's mixed with oil. This technique's been around for 5,000 years or something. And then you pour molten metal into that mold and poof, you have whatever it is. And so, that is a very good and efficient use of 3D printing to make mission critical parts if you can sand cast your part. So there's that.
And, of course, for some applications, a composite part made of plastic and fibers is actually better than a metal part. We all know that SpaceX is converting things that are typically made of metal into composites. And there's this machine that we've mentioned a couple of times that can print composite parts with continuous fibers. It's important to recognize the difference between a continuous fiber and chopped fibers, which you can print on any just about any 3D printer. There are materials that have very fine pieces of carbon fiber mixed into the filament, and those don't add significant amount of strength. In fact, they can actually weaken a print in some cases, but they do make it stiffer. But the continuous carbon fiber can, in some cases, make a part that it has a better strength to weight ratio than metal.
One of the challenges in the space environment, of course, is vacuum, and I'm not aware of what materials that are common have been tested in vacuum or not. And, you know, the UV environment you get in space, which could be challenging for a lot of these plastics. So, you know, a lot of it comes down to, with the low cost 3D printers are printing natively in plastic. We're not including nylon in a plastic. And so the real question is what mission critical parts can be plastic, really? If we're talking about these cheaper printers, because they print in plastic, you know, or can you make something that, then you can use traditional casting methods, based on this thing that you've made made out of plastic?
Linda's in New Orleans. And she says, I'm really curious if you have a 3D printer on the space station or in space, what is the role of gravity for a 3D printer?
Well, for filament printers, which is what we've been talking about, doesn't matter particularly.
Really, it could be upside down and work?
As a matter of fact, Rich is smiling because Rich has designed several printers, and one of them, one of the things we do as a demo is we hold it upside down, and it doesn't matter. Because the printers are, you know, you're sort of squeezing this viscous, mostly molten plastic that's still kind of tacky, out of a nozzle and sort of pushing it against other plastic. And so, you know, if it sticks, it sticks. And so it doesn't really matter. There are a few other issues that are a little more subtle, but for the most part, it's not going to do very much.
And the materials we choose and the temperatures at which we process them are chosen such that the surface tension of the material is going to be a much stronger force than gravity.
Huh. So even on the moon at 1/6 gravity, it wouldn't be a big deal.
No, I mean, it really doesn't matter. I mean, the main time it does matter is if you're trying to do one of these things involving, regolith. Powder is a whole different story, right? Because you would have a cloud of powder inside your,
right,
your zero G, and that's not going to work. But if you're working with filament, or, you know, if you have at least some gravity for the powders, I don't think I'd want to do a powder printer on the moon. I think we're looking at each other going, without a lot of thought to how you manage the binder and stuff. But, and people have been thinking about that. People have talked about these printers much more for Mars and using Martian megalith than anything else.
That sintering printer I mentioned, though, might actually be more easy to operate on the moon because you don't have the atmosphere attenuating sunlight and the material is easier to move around.
Do you see the use of 3D printers opening up or really playing a role in expanding entrepreneurial startup space companies?
Well, I think one thing that the commonest use that we see other than outside education is making mock-ups. I think if you really want to see if this will fit into that, or, you know, how will this work in a person's hand or something like that. And maybe eventually you will cast it or have it made out of some extremely expensive material that you know will work in vacuum. But if you just want to kind of have one to mess around with, you know, you can do. The beauty of a 3D printer is, first of all, you make one and you say, oh, that didn't work, and 5 minutes later, you can make a design change, and a couple hours later, you'll have another one. So that, you know, some of your listeners like me might be old enough to remember when you did computer programming in the 80s, you had to submit stuff overnight. And that meant you spent a lot of time checking your computer program before you submitted it, excuse me, for the night. This is sort of like that, in that right now, if you're going to make something physical, you make it really right before you send it out to have a mock-up made because it's expensive and it's slow. But if you have a 3D printer, it's sort of like a, you know, a compiler for physical stuff. You know, you try something and you print it out and you say, and you change it, and you can do that, and you can do that all quickly. And furthermore, if you have a friend across the country you're collaborating with, you don't have to mail it to them. You send them the file. Say, print this out and, you know, see what this looks like. What do you think? And so I think at the moment the power is in the design stage when you're making something. And maybe, you know, for real life you might make it out of something else if you're in an environment where you have to control your materials and really understand them very well.
And, of course, 3D printing is most economical compared to other ways of making things when the quantity is one. As the quantity increases, other manufacturing techniques become more economical. But a low quantity is good for prototyping. You can make variations of things and iterate very quickly. And also, when you need to customize things, if you need many of one thing, but each one needs to be a little bit different in some specific way, then 3D printing all of them might make more sense than making a mold for each one.
Doug had another question for you. Do you have an opinion about 3D printing of habitats on the moon or Mars? I personally think that 3D printing them would be more complex than using inflatable habitats. So do you guys have any thoughts on that, printing
perhaps?
Well,
I think it depends on the mission, you know. I mean, if you're going to be there for a week, you probably want to inflate something and sit in it, right? If you're trying to make something you're going to be there for a really long time, then, you know, an inflatable, you know, is sooner or later something's going to pop it, right?
Well, maybe. I don't know. That's pretty hard stuff.
Yeah, well, maybe not. I don't know. But that's a very interesting trade-off. I think it would be something where I would want to really do a bit of a trade study on time and understand what my 3D printing technique looked like for how long it would take for whatever it was, you know, and how long I planned to be there and how big the thing was and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's an interesting technique for building things up. It's not all that mature yet. I think, like everything else, as it matures, it will probably get faster.
You said that they're slow, so do they consume a lot of power to do their printing? Like, if you're using them in space, would giving it enough power to do its job be a problem?
A desktop 3D printer has a power consumption comparable to a desktop PC without the monitor. It has to be running for a while. But it doesn't consume any super high amount of power as it's doing it.
So while it's running, it's about that of a desktop computer.
Yeah. I mean, if you're printing concrete and you're moving around concrete, most of the power is going to be moving around the concrete or regolith or whatever it is.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that's going to be, you know, doing that with a skip loader isn't going to be particularly low power either.
And, of course, if you're using a 1,000-watt laser to sinter powder, it's using 1,000 watts whenever it's running, so plus whatever it takes to keep that cool.
Listeners, there's still time if you want to use the phone instead of email tonight. Phone calls are always better. I say that on every show. 1-866-687-7223, and email will continue for the evening at drspace@thespaceshow.com. What is the status of 3D printing in other countries? Is it advancing like in the United States? Is it a rare item? Is it unheard of? Are we the leaders in the industry?
So a lot of the development is taking place in Europe. That's where the RepRap project, which is the project to make 3D printers out of 3D printed parts, began. And a lot of this development is happening as an open source project that people all over the world are collaborating on.
So it's everywhere.
Yep.
And the Chinese probably are starting to own the consumer end of it.
Why is that?
Cost. I mean, they have the infrastructure to make. Basically, a 3D printer is a very simple household robot. You know, and simple household robots is something that Shenzhen and China, I mean, that's what the city's for, to first order. And, you know, they're good at it. And, so they can make the price come way down. And so a lot of them are there.
And because a lot of these designs are open source, it's easy for them to, use these open source designs and produce a machine, at lower cost than people in other countries can.
So Doug is on a roll tonight, so he has, this is his third question. Fortunately, we have no quotas on the space show. Doug says, have you guys discussed, and no, we have not discussed, Doug, the abrasive nature of regolith, basically it's small bits of broken glass. How concerning do you think this is, and would that affect 3D printing?
For 3D printing, it might actually even be a plus.
Why is that?
Because it could help keep that material stacked on itself as it's being bound together.
You might have to replace your nozzle a lot.
Yeah, depending on what process you're using to bind it together, yes.
So it would keep the material together while it's binding? Is that what you're
talking
about?
Potentially, yeah.
And then is it when it's finished, it's still rough then, right? It's still abrasive, correct?
It depends on the process you're using. If you're using a binding agent, it may fill most of that area. But of course, you can always, once you've got a surface, you can always take some subtractive machine to that to smooth it out.
So Doug is a doctor, and I sometimes read, he's a medical doctor, and I sometimes read articles where people that have certain kinds of bone problems or other issues can have custom 3D printed hip joints, for example, specific for their problem, or a custom 3D printed knee or some part for replacement. What type of printers are doing that kind of work?
I think that's titanium, so that would be one of the very expensive printers.
But there are prosthetics are a great application for 3D printing because those generally need to be custom to the wearer.
Uh-huh.
So there are projects to do low-cost prosthetics, particularly hands, especially for children who have been injured.
Wait a minute, they're printing a whole hand?
Well, they're kind of they're called e-nable hands, and they're kind of they're not accurate representations. They're many of them are meant to be like superhero hands, but they're a simple grasping hand that has five fingers. And basically the parts can be printed very easily on one of these cheap printers, so a lot of schools do it as a project. So somebody who needs one of these hands puts in a request, and then there's a central nonprofit that handles, you know, farming these out to schools or people who have printers to make the parts, and then they are assembled. They're very ingenious things with basically some cables and simple plastic parts.
They don't have any sensory anything in them. They're just
hand. They're just, you know, if you can't afford it, if you're in the third world, or if you're somebody here who doesn't have insurance to cover it, or your kid is growing rapidly, you know, they work surprisingly well for what they are, and they really enable e-nable.org probably, but enable. I think it's called Enabling the Future. I think is their website. But they've done some marvelous work with these very simple printers, and a lot of kids have contributed to helping other kids that way.
I guess you could print a hook up for a hand too, like in the old days, right?
Yeah, you could do lots of things.
But people are doing much more sophisticated things with 3D printed hands.
Amazing how all this is changing. So I know that they print crowns and stuff for teeth. I've heard of that before. And things of that nature, so I'm aware of that.
In that case, they're actually probably printing a mold and then using a more biocompatible material.
Something, they do it right in front of you, and you walk out with a completed crown. So none of this other kind of stuff like you have to wait and come back for the crown to be made at the lab or anything like that?
Yeah, I think those may be subtractive, actually. They may drill them out, but I know they're, some of them are subtractive, which means that instead of laying up layers, they're basically a mill and drilling it out.
They draw it out.
Yeah.
Where do you see all of this in 5 years from now? Is it going to be so radically different that we won't even recognize the industry and what's a 3D product and what's not a 3D product?
Well, you know, it's consolidating right now. I mean, right now, it's sort of, you know, the Gartner hype cycle, right? You know, so that there's, you know, great expectations. And I think we are, the hype cycle kind of, we went over the top and now we're kind of, we went down in sort of the valley of disillusionment when people couldn't just buy a printer that would do everything. And now I think we're sort of in this sober stage where people are saying, okay, so this is an interesting technology, and where does it make sense to apply it? And I think there'll be more consolidation for a while. A lot of the little guys, you know, may not survive or may get combined because there's too many people in the market right now. And so we're seeing consolidation and people, you know, kind of getting together and some of the weaker players getting shaken out. So I think that will continue for a couple of years, and they'll get easier to use. You know, certainly we're trying to contribute to that in various ways. And I think the material science part of it is going to be very interesting for a while as people try to figure out new materials, better materials for more applications. I don't know if Rich wants to add something to that. Yeah.
Well, it would be typical that it would consolidate, you know, because it's had such a rapid, you know, jump upwards. And I would imagine that there will be a lot of continued consolidation and people will go out of business and some will survive. And it'll be more or less into a typical business cycle then is what you're really saying. 4 or 5 years from now.
And then people are doing interesting things, like there's a company called Organovo down in San Diego-ish that is printing living human organs. You know, they have, I don't know what they're doing exactly because they're not selling printers. They're selling the results of using their printers. But they make tissue, you know, tissue in skin sense, you know, they lay up a matrix somehow with a 3D printer and they insert living cells into it. So I think that is certainly a really interesting area. And so I think as the mainstream of these plastic printers kind of consolidates, I think there will be a lot of offshoots doing interesting niche and not so niche things like that.
Is any of this industry regulated now, or does it come under any category of some type of limiting regulatory process or OSHA?
Well, for food, the things have to be food safe, which means they have to be, in the U.S., means they have to be sterilizable. So that's a pretty big design constraint if you're going to do something that is food grade.
So the printer has to be sterilizable?
Yeah, well, anything that touches the food, the feedstock has to be. So, you know, if you see anything that's printing like chocolate or sugar or something, they have to be able to have a whole chain there that anything that touches the food has to be food safe, which is challenging.
And of course, if you're using it in a company, in a production environment, there are the standard safety regulations involved with that. But most of the regulations would be involved in whatever you're using the 3D printed parts for.
Yeah, if it's in a medical application, then you're up against FDA things, probably.
You have another listener. So in terms of regulatory, it would be the category and purpose for what it's being used that would be the controlling agent there.
Yeah, and I mean, beyond sort of the usual consumer product stuff, yeah.
Underwriter Laboratories, okay.
Or whatever.
Tim is in Huntsville, and he says, what steps would be needed to develop technology to sort through the different elements in raw ore for metallic parts or carbonaceous chondrites for volatile elements for plastics or lubricants? This is for feedstock for 3D printers.
So in other words, if I'm maybe to parse the question a little bit, you're on a planet, and how do I figure out what I can use to 3D print? Is that sort of what that question is, I think?
I don't know. Let me read it again real slowly, because I don't know either. What steps would be needed to develop the technology to sort through the different elements in raw ore for metallic parts or carbonaceous chondrites, for volatile elements for plastics or lubricants, and this is for feedstock for 3D printers?
The exact same technology that you'd use to do those, not for 3D printers. 3D printing is one potential application for such technologies, but it's not the ability to do that for 3D printing is not really any different from the ability to do that for other purposes.
Yeah, one thing we often get asked is, well, can't I throw my recycled plastic into a 3D printer? And the answer is no, because the current generation of 3D printers, the cheap ones, have kind of outsourced some of their complexity to the filament, to the feedstock. So the feedstock has to be very pure. It has to be a very stable diameter or all heck breaks loose. So, you know, a 3D printer at the moment has been optimized that way, that the printer is pretty simple, but the stuff you feed it has to be pretty decent precision. If you're going to do this on another planet, then, you know, what you would do is make some trade-offs about how much you purify your stuff before you start to use it in a printer, you know, and then, so that's a system engineering question sort of end to end.
Also, the metals used for cans and the plastics used for bottles are very carefully formulated to be optimized for those purposes. And the metal used for a can is not very good for casting, and likewise the plastic, the specific formula of plastic used in soda bottles is about as bad as you can get for the purposes of 3D printing. There are, however, there are the same, nominally the same material, but a slightly different, very different formulation for it that is one of the popular 3D printing materials called PETG.
Fascinating. So one really has a lot to understand if they're going to use 3D printing in their business. I guess they don't have to have all this knowledge. They just have to know what they can do with their specific printer that's applicable to what they want to do.
Or what kind of problem they're trying to solve. I mean, the most useful problem at the moment that you can solve with a 3D printer is I need to have a 3D prototype of something to understand it really well. And then, you know, whether you can fly that or not, you know, becomes a material science question. And a requirements on your material question, really.
So basically, you take your CAD drawing and turn it into a 3D model to see if it's going to do the job.
Yeah, you know, I mean, architects have been very early adopters, product designers, and people like
right. That.
A lot of folks that we know that bought one early, you know, are in those spaces because people who would have at some point, you know, taken an X-Acto knife and made themselves a foam core model, you know, now make a 3D printed one.
I don't know why Tim is asking this, but maybe one of you knows the answer to it. Ask if your guests are familiar with the concept of a von Neumann probe.
So a von Neumann probe is one that that can reproduce itself and send off more probes like itself. Certainly 3D printing would probably be a vital component of such a probe because you need to be able to use whatever materials the probe would encounter in order to make more of itself.
So it keeps regenerating as it goes out there.
Yeah.
Very good question, Tim. Thank you. Do you think what's the average life expectancy of one of these $1,000 to $3,000 printers If you use normal use for it, I don't know what normal use for it, but let's say average use, are they trouble-free? Are they repairable, or do you throw them away like an old VCR? Or, I mean, what do you do with them?
So there are some standard issues that you can have. One of the most common being a clogged nozzle. That can be caused by something as simple as dust on the filament being dragged into the nozzle and building up. There are also just filament jams where the filament might go out of tolerance briefly and jam up in the machine, or the thermal management fails and causes a jam. But these are generally fairly easy problems to solve. The biggest problem is that some people give bad advice about how to solve them online.
And they break them up, huh?
Yeah. But as far as if you maintain a machine well and know what you're doing when you're doing this kind of maintenance on it, the machine will be obsolete long before it becomes unusable.
They're pretty simple things, you know. I mean, they're precision, but they're quite, you know, the ones that we use are quite elegant and simple machines because Rich designed them. But, you know, there's no, you know, if you have them in a clean environment, the commonest mistake we see people make is that they put them in their wood shop, which is fatal because they're, you know, they're precision electronic devices, and if there's a lot of dust, particularly wood dust, bad things happen, and you know, they're not going to survive.
So you have to treat them as a precision piece of equipment.
Yeah.
Well, you just don't want it to get in a super dirty, super dusty environment or temperature extremes. You know, they want to be more in a computer lab with a bit of ventilation than they want to be in a shop kind of environment. I mean, you want to, you know, the PLA isn't too bad, but a lot of the other printing materials do have, you know, do smell, and you want to have good ventilation. We usually recommend that people have ventilation sort of no matter what, as an abundance of caution.
And so for reference, the common inexpensive printing technology is basically equivalent to a robotic precision glue gun.
Okay.
So imagine a motorized glue. You know, basically these things are heating up plastic. Like if your listeners are familiar with a hot glue gun, I mean, it's just basically a hot glue gun that you've programmed to make something.
Right. What should we have talked about that we've omitted or forgotten or that I haven't asked you? What else did you want to be sure to get across to the listeners today?
Well, I think it's 3D printing is a really interesting technology, but I think it has been promoted as you know, able to eat your Wheaties for breakfast for you, you know, and I'm not quite sure why it has gotten so over the top, but I think now that people who are perhaps worried about it being a little too over the top, you know, have reacted to that and now are saying it's good for nothing, and obviously either extreme is wrong. And so I think right now, you know, a lot of what we heard is, you know, oh, it's good for everything, and now we hear, oh, that, you know, 3D printing, no, that turned out not being good, let's go on to the next thing. And I think neither extreme is right, you know. And I think, like any tool, it just requires some thoughtful application and some thought and some testing for critical applications, you know, before we run off one way or the other.
Okay, I got one more email question in from Doug. So I'll get this in. It'll be our last question for the night. For an IRSU workshop on the moon or Mars, would 3D printers replace all other machines such as lathes, presses, and rollers making sheets? Thanks, Doug, Southern California.
So there are types of precision that you can get with a 3D printer and types of precision that you can't. So if you need a precision a very smooth rolling surface for a roughly cylindrical part. A lathe is never is always going to be better than a 3D printer for making that smooth surface. There are hybrid additive and subtractive manufacturing machines that can be used to make some of these types of surfaces and shapes. And that type of machine may replace those other discrete machines.
Rich, any concluding comments for you?
I think I'm good.
And Joan, anything you want to, any pearls of wisdom you want to leave us with, or you want to give us out some more information about your company and website?
So our website is nonscriptum, nonscriptum.com, and I guess it'll be on David's site as well.
Right.
And so we have five books out right now, and those are all linked on the site if you're interested. In our classes are on the site under classes as well, so if they're interested in that. And if any of your listeners are doing something interesting in maker technologies with a scientific bent, as I said, we're co-chairing an event for American Association for Advancement of Science Pacific Division this June, and we have a contact us through our website, and they can get a hold of us for more information there about that if they want to.
Okay. I appreciate your coming on. Do you have another book in the works, by the way?
Yeah, we're working on some more, another science projects book, so that'll be out in late spring, early summer sometime.
Okay. I'll look forward to your letting me know about it. And I want to thank you both for being on and clearing up a lot of misconceptions I think a lot of us have had about the wonder drug of 3D printing. You know, that we're, I guess it is kind of a wonder drug to many of us because we keep hearing it is going to change the world and do everything.
Well, thank you for having us on. We appreciate it.
I appreciate it, too, and the listeners do. And I'll get the show archived early in the morning and send it to you both, and we'll look forward to talking to you again.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, and listeners, that's it. So I do want to say goodnight from Joan and Rich, myself, and the Space Show, and Hotel Mars is tomorrow, and then back again Friday and Sunday for more Space Show programming. Thank you, everybody. Have a good night. Goodbye.